Not many people enjoy going to the doctor. This is especially true for men. Waiting until they are sick, men simply miss opportunities for early detection and treatment of many preventable illnesses. Some of these illnesses are potentially fatal if they are not treated early. Many men suffer from depression and simply don't choose to address it, or experience weight gain or loss of physical endurance, yet fail to change their diets or implement a simple exercise routine. Tonight, we hope that we can create some awareness and that for men, paying attention to the physical and mental health can help them to live a happier and healthier life. Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. For the next hour, we will be discussing men's health. Our guests tonight include Dr. Lauren Smith from Urology at Piermont, part of the Willis-Knighton Health System, Dr. Mark Vegan, a clinical psychologist in Shreveport, and Terry Eberhardt, physical therapist with Eberhardt Physical Therapy in Shreveport. As always, we invite you to join our discussion. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502, or contact us via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Smith, what are some of the important issues medically that men should address?
I think there are a number of important issues, but first of all, I should thank you for inviting me to be a part of this this discussion tonight. Probably the hottest topic, or one of the hottest topics that you see in the media and that men talk about is testosterone replacement. And that has been around for a long time, but it's really beginning to get a lot of airplay, a lot of discussion, and there's debate that's ongoing and will be ongoing for quite a while. I think PSA testing for prostate cancer screening is also a very significant issue. And again, there's been a lot of debate, particularly over the past 2 or 3 years, where you have kind of the AUA pitting itself against, or not really against, but with one set of ideas versus Preventive Medicine Task Force having a different set of ideas, and trying to meld those into good recommendations for patients is another long discussion.
So clearly, urological issues are of primary importance to urology specialists as yourself. There are also a number of medical conditions. And let's start by covering just a few general health topics briefly. You know, if you haven't seen a physician within the past 1 or 2 years, men should consider having having screenings for prostate cancer, for colon cancer, having a heart evaluation if they have a family history of heart disease, or cardiac risk factors such as a smoking history, if they have high cholesterol, or if they are overweight. A chest CT is now recommended for men who have had a 30-year pack or greater history of smoking, especially if they are over 50. And they should always see their primary care physician at least regularly to be checked for diabetes, heart disease, and screening for cholesterol. Dr. Vegan, welcome to Health Matters.
Dr. Brewer, thank you very much for including me.
What are some of the important mental health issues that you see in men?
Well, I guess certainly talking about how men present regarding anxiety versus, and including how they present with regard to depression. I think men present differently than women regarding those two issues, anxiety and depression. And I think there's a number of reasons for that, which we can discuss as we go forward. And then I think men generally are less focused on what are the really good rules for mental health and living a mentally healthy life. I mean, we all know not to smoke. We all know to exercise. We all know to rest properly and to see, you know, to seek medical help. But most men aren't necessarily terribly aware of what are the basic rules of good mental health. So we can discuss some of those as we proceed, along with the topics of depression and anxiety.
As always, we invite you to join our discussion. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502, or you can contact us via Twitter at RRR Public Radio. Mr. Eberhardt, thank you for joining us tonight. You know, routine exercise is really important, especially as men get older. Many men simply don't have much time to exercise. So how can men stay fit when they have a busy schedule?
Well, thanks for having me also. It's just really interesting you asked that. There is a lot of men that I see every day in the world of physical therapy, but there's people every day asking about exercise and how do you have time to fit it in? What are we supposed to do? And these are all questions that are can be individualized through these people seeing their doctor and then having somebody work with them to help them show how to get the time and make the time to do it, because it's so important for your health, for your mental and physical health. The exercise is very important.
You know, Dr. Smith, you mentioned testosterone as one of the primary things that, you know, men are getting a lot of attention for. We see testosterone on billboards. You see, you know, advertisements for testosterone replacement on TV and in magazines. Tell us a little bit about testosterone.
It's become a huge part of my practice lately. I think over the past 2 or 3 years, I've seen an exponential rise in the number of men, young and old, that come in for an evaluation. You know, it used to be that we'd see maybe one a month, one a week, if that, and now it's a couple a day, it seems like. Again, the word is out. Testosterone replacement is, from a medical standpoint, I'm going to say it's a relatively new experience. We don't have a lot of long-term data in terms of where we're heading with this. And one of my concerns is that we're going to be in a similar situation to where we were with female estrogen replacement, in terms of not really understanding what the 20, 30-year implications are in terms of side effects and bad outcomes. We know today that it can help the right patient. Many men come in thinking that because they have a specific number that may be low, that that's a problem. But that really may not be. And when I talk to patients about it, you know, I read a quote and that basically low testosterone is a number, not a syndrome. And I think that that's important to get across, because it's not about the number as much as it is about the symptoms. There are a number of theoretical health advantages. Some have been proven, some will be proven over time. But I think there are a lot of complications that we're going to be looking at 20, 30 years from now that we don't recognize today. Today, however, I think that we know that testosterone replacement can be associated with stroke, increased risk of stroke, increased risk of MI or heart attack. You know, it causes other kind of superficial problems, acne, depending upon the type of testosterone replacement you have. So I think it's very important to see whether or not patients really have a benefit in their in terms of symptom reduction before we continue them on testosterone replacement.
So you mentioned replacement, and I think most people are probably familiar with the term testosterone. And I understand it is a steroid. It's a steroidal hormone. It's produced, you know, by the testicles, the
true
glands.
Yes, that's correct.
For men, but it's also produced in women. So what really is the function of testosterone, and what would we see if that function starts to drop as men get older?
So testosterone is controlled by an axis, and essentially you have substances that are produced in the brain that then act on the testicle to make testosterone. Testosterone does a couple things. Number one, very high levels in the testicle help produce sperm. You have to have extremely high levels to produce sperm, which is an important feature. We can talk about that later. We'll get back to that later, I'm sure, when we talk about some infertility issues. But what testosterone really does for you and I and the men that are listening is virilization. It makes us who we are. It gives us a deeper voice. It gives us facial hair. It gives us muscle mass. It keeps us from becoming tired easily. Gives us sex drive, libido, which is a huge issue for a lot of men. So it kind of makes us who we are.
Makes us who we are. And so should we have lower testosterones as we get older? Testosterone levels, should they drop?
Absolutely.
So that's a normal part of aging. And so when does it begin to drop out of proportion to what it should as a normal human being? And how do we know that that's out of the normal range?
I think that's part of the golden question. I don't know that we really know. My understanding of the data is that we don't have a clear understanding of what normals really are from a level standpoint. Or a serum, you know, serum test. So what does your testosterone level? You know, most of the studies that were done traditionally, you know, 40 years ago or longer, were done on young, healthy men. And a young, healthy man is going to have a much higher testosterone level than a guy who's 80 years old who may not be healthy. Or you get sick and your level may go down. So I don't know that anyone can really answer that question right now.
Terry, I'm sure you're seeing men. They may be complaining of fatigue. They're trying to get going with exercise. Maybe they're getting a little bit older. They've lost some endurance. Maybe they've lost some strength. Does testosterone ever come up in that evaluation?
Yes, almost every day now. And I think the media has really brought it on to a higher level now for people to ask about this. And they're going in to their doctors and finding out what their levels are and coming to me and asking me about this, because I see it greatly with aging male population, the lack of wanting to work out, the ability to the drive is just goes down as the testosterone levels go down.
And so these men who are coming to see you and they talk about testosterone to you, and they, let's say they go to their physician, they have their testosterone levels checked, and maybe they get on testosterone replacement. What's your experience in following these men through exercise?
Well, I followed this for a long time, even back when the athletes were abusing the testosterone too. But I see it especially now with the older men. Their strength levels, their muscle mass is all improving.
So you see that their muscle mass is improving. Is this something that you've seen differently that's occurring now, say, compared to maybe 10 or 15 years ago before testosterone replacement wasn't as prevalent?
Yeah, 10 years ago, I never saw a man own testosterone unless there was somebody trying to, in some athletic endeavor.
Yeah, so we have to remember, Dr. Smith, and maybe you'll elaborate, testosterone is an androgenic steroid, and so we talk about doping in athletes, you know, really increasing muscle mass with, say, weightlifting or bodybuilding. That basically is a black market form of testosterone, is it not?
Absolutely. And it's from my standpoint, it's scary, because when I have a guy who is presenting wanting testosterone, most of these gentlemen have done their research. They kind of know what they're asking for. They know what's available. They know what's not available. They know what their friends are taking. And they have an agenda. Now, for most of them, I think it's a legitimate agenda to feel better. They're tired. They have a poor sex drive. They're having other issues, weight gain. They're young, and they just feel lousy, and they've got a very low level. Those guys need to be treated. The men that are more difficult for me are the ones who may have a normal level. And how do you define a normal level? I said earlier, we really don't know. And I still kind of stand by that. But, you know, traditionally we say that the normal serum value can run anywhere from around 250 up to about 1,000 nanograms per milliliter. And it's going to vary depend on the assay that you use. So it's kind of like going to the store and buying apples. You know, there are 10 different types of apples. They're all going to taste a little bit different, but they're all still apples. Testosterone testing is going to be the same. Depending upon which test you buy, you're going to get a slightly different value. But in general, men who have a value below 200 are symptomatic. Above 200, they may or may not be symptomatic. But you can have a guy with a value of 300 or 400 who may be symptomatic. So where do you draw the line, in terms of treatment? For me personally, I believe in symptoms. I believe that we treat based on symptoms for men that have low or borderline low levels. Part of the problem with the way that we're approaching it now, though, is, again, the men come in with an agenda. They want to feel better, or they want to feel like their friend. The physician treating them may or may not obtain a testosterone level. Or we may just treat even with a normal testosterone level and then not follow up to see if patients are doing better. Part of the problem also is getting the dosing right. You can really feel good when you get a very high level. So if your level goes up above 1,000, you feel great. You're manic, you're hypersexual. It can be a crazy experience for the patient, and they don't like coming down off of that. So it's a tightrope trying to get them comfortable, get their symptoms under control, not push them too far so that you don't have to bring them back.
And so the symptoms are subjective.
Absolutely.
So the symptoms are subjective. The level is obviously objective, but in that borderline case and you have subjective symptoms, there's got to be a differential diagnosis, right? You know, fatigue, reduced libido, maybe
sure.
Some depression, things along those lines.
Sure.
So for the primary care physicians out there, what is that differential diagnosis, and what other testing might they consider when they're looking at testosterone as part of the picture?
I don't know that testosterone should be the primary focus, to be honest. So I would prefer that they look at it from a global health standpoint, diabetes, hypertension, like you mentioned, depression, because that plays a huge role. Even as a surgeon, I hate to admit it, but the mind's a very powerful tool. And, we can not necessarily cure disease by getting patients in the right frame of mind, but we can certainly improve their outlook and make things better by getting them in the right frame of mind. So I'd like to see primary care doctors approach it from a global standpoint and then cone it down to testosterone. As a urologist, most patients come in thinking that their issues are testosterone related, and so they may or may not have appropriate primary care follow-up before seeing me. So I really try and focus on the testosterone, see if that is the issue, maybe treat them, see how their symptoms are. If the symptoms don't improve, talk them out of getting off treatment.
So for primary care, the general differential diagnosis for fatigue and depression, screening for diabetes, as you mentioned, looking at blood pressure control, maybe a referral for depression, mm-hmm. maybe looking at things like iron, hemoglobin, thyroid functions, things along those lines.
Exactly.
So Dr. Vegan, the mind is a powerful tool. What does testosterone play in your role in terms of what you're seeing in terms of depression and anxiety in men?
Well, that's a difficult question for me, Dr. Brewer. A lot of men don't come in and ask me anything about testosterone. Although, if I might, could I ask Dr. Smith a question about testosterone just real quickly?
Please.
I was wondering, in terms of what you were saying, are there some negative psychological effects to men who perhaps are taking too much testosterone versus men who have too little testosterone
sure.
that you've noticed in your practice?
Sure. I think that most men, again, men below, with a level below 200, again, are usually symptomatic. And so my experience is that they almost present with easy fatigue. Mm. They would need to take naps in the afternoon. There are significant relationship problems, lack of libido or very poor libido, which can kind of generate a lack of erections. So on the negative side, they become very flat. They become passive. Their spouses or partners get very frustrated with the fact that they're not the same man that they were 5 or 10 years ago. They're not interested in having fun. They have anhedonia. They're just not interested in doing the things that they used to do to enjoy life in general. On the other extreme, again, they kind of develop a high. They become almost manic, aggressive. Their personality changes in the other direction. And so, again, I think the treatment is trying to find that middle ground to make them comfortable with who they are and fit into their normal life cycle again.
Dr. Vegan, in the psychological literature, is testosterone known to precipitate a manic attack or increase aggression in men who have a history of violence or aggression?
I don't know about the manic issue. I can't answer that question. I don't know the literature in that area. I like Dr. Smith's answer very, but rage attacks, becoming extremely angry, those are concerns for me in my practice when men have that kind of issue. If they're becoming rageful and losing emotional control, they lack emotional modulation at the upper end. An overdose of testosterone or high levels of testosterone may be playing into that issue.
Do you see that men who have these sort of rage attacks, are they predisposed to those with certain stresses, or how do you approach that as a psychologist? Because it's a fairly unique symptom to males.
It is. I think... one of the things that I am aware of with men is a lot of us, particularly high-achieving men, we're sort of given childhood messages. And the messages that men get are to be strong, to make it, to succeed. And so men start out on a life path where, they're seeking success, self-esteem, self-worth, then becomes tied up with productivity. The more productive, the more more self-esteem, and so on. And so they become very future-oriented. And, of course, the opposite of the message to make it and be successful is the fear that, oh, my gosh, I might not make it. I might not be successful. And so there's this orientation of tying self-esteem to productivity. There's an orientation to always looking into the future. And there is a loss of learning how to live in the present. which in my belief is the primary and best rule of mental health, is that healthy people live in the present. Doesn't mean they don't plan, doesn't mean they don't look to the past to learn and so on, but they generally spend the majority of their time living in the present, creating joy in the present, and creating a good future for themselves, and looking at the past in a way that's productive and in which they learn. And I think men oftentimes, because of their need to succeed and need to make it, often lose that primary mental health perspective.
And Terry, this need to succeed means a lot of time at work and not very much time for exercise. And so that can be frustrating as well. They come in and they want to get on a new exercise program. Do you see self-esteem rising as physical health rises as well?
Definitely. Their self-esteem will rise in a matter of 4 to 6 weeks of exercise programs. And I'm pretty sure also, and everybody would agree, their testosterone levels can increase too from that, from the exercise program. I'm not sure how much it increases, but I believe a lot of testosterone can be stimulated with the exercise program also.
Yeah, that's a good question. Dr. Smith, have you seen patients who are able to exercise, build some muscle mass, and actually come down off of testosterone replacement? Maybe let's say someone who may be a little bit overweight, deconditioned, they get into an exercise program, build some muscle mass, and then maybe have their testosterone levels rechecked and wean off of the medicine.
I can't say I've seen that, but I can certainly see a case for it in terms of overweight patients. Because obviously, larger body mass, larger fat mass, if you will, relates to higher estrogen levels and kind of a conversion from testosterone to estrogen. So I think that if men can become fitter, then they will have less of that conversion and maintain potentially some of their testosterone level. But I don't have any data on that.
You know, you mentioned one of the symptoms of low testosterone was reduced libido, which could, have some relationship to erectile dysfunction. But erectile dysfunction is obviously a significant mental or physical health issue with men as well.
It's both.
Yeah. So how can we distinguish between libido and erectile dysfunction? Because I understand they're very similar. Obviously, they're linked, but they're not all entirely together, right?
You're asking a great question, and that's a point that I try and bring up daily with the men that come in with, saying that they have trouble in bed, because there's a delusion or a belief that low testosterone causes erectile dysfunction or the lack of an erection. And that's really not true. Rarely is that the case. In fact, the old data would suggest that about 1% or less of erectile dysfunction can be adequately treated with testosterone replacement. So what happens is, and what I ask guys that come in with that question, just like you asked it, I say, do you want to have sex with your wife? And they say yes. And I say that you don't have a testosterone problem. It's really that simple. Even if they're borderline low, if they want to have sex, it's an erection, it's a hydraulics problem. Then we're down a whole different pathway. So it's just the desire. Libido is nothing more than the desire.
Again, we invite you to join our discussion. We'll take your questions at 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our panelists tonight, Dr. Lauren Smith from Urology at Piermont, Terry Eberhardt from Eberhardt Physical Therapy, and Dr. Mark Vegan, clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. Again, Dr. Smith, we're talking about libido and erectile dysfunction. Talk to us a little bit about what is erectile dysfunction and how is it approached? How is it diagnosed? What's the differential diagnosis and how is it treated?
That's a very long topic. I think that...
We have 35 minutes left. So.
Okay, good. Well, let's get to it. The erectile dysfunction is very common. And we again, the media is playing a big role in men's health right now because we're seeing it more and more on TV. You see the ads for Viagra and Cialis. You know, everybody knows what the blue pill is. Everybody knows what the bathtubs are. And it's just the reality of marketing, direct marketing to patients, fortunately or unfortunately. But erectile dysfunction is basically the inability to have a satisfactory erection. It could be an inability to achieve any erection. It could be early loss of an erection before, during, or during intercourse. It could be that a man comes in and he says, I can't have sex four times anymore, and that's a problem for him. So it's really a patient-defined problem, but it is a problem. And so our goal is to figure out what their goal is with their erection, with their sexual experience, and then kind of treat it appropriately. What are the causes? There are multiple causes. We used to really get wrapped around the axle and trying to figure out what the issue is. Is it a neurologic problem? Is it a blood flow problem? Is it that they can't hold the blood in the penis to keep it erect? I tell patients now that doesn't really matter because the treatments are basically the same. Most men are older. There's a younger population with ED that's basically psychogenic, and that's a whole different ball game. But most men that come in with it are older, although I do see men routinely in their 40s and 50s that have poor quality erections. And most of those men have been seen by their primary care doctor. So we talked about screening earlier. Most patients are being screened for those other medical conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, things like that. One thing that's interesting and it's kind of important to recognize is that erectile dysfunction can precede heart disease by about 10 years. There's some good emerging data looking at the correlation between the two, and it probably has to do with the vasculature, very small arteries leading to the penis to give you an erection, and those arteries are easily going to get plaque buildup as opposed to coronary arteries, which may be a little bit larger and take a little bit longer to develop the same plaques. So it makes sense when you really think about it from a medical standpoint. But it's multifactorial. There's always some sort of nerve involvement. The nerves provide substances that create the ability for veins to dilate and hold on to that blood for an erection. And so the treatments are really starting out usually with oral medications, kind of Viagra, Cialis, medicines like that, Levitra. Don't want to cherry pick and not name the ones that are out there. And then move on to other treatments if those are not effective.
Is there any difference between the drugs? You mentioned Viagra, Cialis, Levitra. Are there any differences?
There are. I'm going to say minor differences. Cialis has a longer time that it will act than the Levitra and Viagra. I think they're all very similar in their efficacy in terms of how well they work for patients. Not any patient will necessarily have a great result with all three medicines, but I think that all three medicines will work well in the proper patient or in someone.
And remind us which patients should stay away from these drugs.
Patients that take nitroglycerin for chest pain or any type of nitrate for high blood pressure. What basically happens is they both the medicines work together to lower blood pressure. They'll cause stroke and can cause death in some cases.
Dr. Vegan, Dr. Smith mentioned psychogenic erectile dysfunction in younger men. From the psychological perspective, how can younger men understand that better?
Oh, that's a question I haven't dealt with for a long time. I think it's a matter of psychogenic erectile dysfunction and so on probably has to do a lot with, like Dr. Smith said, the mind and attitudes and quality of relationships and the ability to create an intimate relationship, the ability to connect emotionally. And, I think certainly how men learn about sexuality, how men observe their parents, what they're taught, and their view of women, and then their ability to connect at an emotional level are all incredibly important. A lot of the men that I used to work with who had erectile dysfunction problems and psychological causes for those were men that kind of observed themselves, wanted to perform, had expectations of who they should be, and it's sort of like they brought an observing ego into the bedroom with them rather than really tune in emotionally and be present with their partners. And so I think it's a matter of being in the present with a partner, really learning to love that partner, and in that emotional setting add sexuality to that. But that takes a lot of relaxation. It takes a lot of giving up of self, it giving up of expectations, locking the world outside of the bedroom and not bringing the world into the bedroom, not bringing performance demands into the bedroom, those kinds of things. Making quality emotional connections with one's partner, then sexuality becomes a much more enjoyable and relaxed experience. And it can range from anything from a glance at one's partner across the room all the way to any kind of sexual experiences that they want to engage in as adults.
I think that's a good point you mentioned, you know, the performance, bringing performance, you know, outside of the job front, you know, into the bedroom. Perhaps, Terry, you see that brought into sports as well. These men maybe have weekend warrior symptoms, and they're very performance-based in everything that they do.
Yeah. The one thing that I've seen with the difference in the education now of all this, the way it's changed compared to the athletic type use of the, you know, of testosterone, is that it's a better control where it doesn't get to the where it's a problem.
I agree. Yeah. I'd like just to add about psychogenic. I agree with everything that you said. When I was active duty in the Navy, I would see a number of guys, young, 20, 22 years old, with erection problems, and almost invariably it's going to be psychogenic. And, you know, you sit down and you're talking to these kids, and, you know, they've got a wife, they've got three kids, and they're an E3, they're making nothing, they're working for somebody who doesn't like them, and you ask them, do you have any stress? And they say, no. I said, well, wait a minute, you're not getting paid enough, you've got four mouths to feed at home, you know, your boss hates you, his boss hates him and you, you know, of course you have stress. And so I think a big part of what happens is you need to help folks, or we need to help folks cone in on the idea that they need to be able to compartmentalize and separate out their stressors from living in the moment, like you suggest, with their spouse or their partner. And I don't know that we can always, as health professionals, get them to the point of recognizing the individual stressor that may be causing it for them, but even just cluing them into the idea that, hey, the mind's a powerful tool, and there may be something else going on, and maybe I can figure it out as a patient. I think that's very helpful.
So perhaps counseling and a visit to a psychologist would
Absolutely.
Be a good idea to create some self-awareness around what the stressors could be.
Absolutely. And the other thing I'd like to say about that is the oral medicines that we talked about work very well in psychogenic ED. They work actually better in psychogenic than in any other type of erectile dysfunction. And again, I think it goes back to kind of developing a pattern of success where you achieve what you're looking for, and then it becomes easier, and then you can back off the medications and you get them in a cycle of success, and that can help a lot too.
We have a caller from the internet. The question is, what would bright blood in the stool be a sign of? And in general, what we learn in medical school is bright blood anywhere is a sign of something that needs to be immediately evaluated. Typically in the stool, it's a lower gastrointestinal issue. It could be bleeding from the rectum. Hemorrhoids are a common source of bright blood in the stool, but it could be a sign of lower gastrointestinal bleeding, and you should seek immediate medical attention for that. Dr. Smith, you have anything to add?
I agree. I think that being seen by the primary care physician is going to be important, or potentially self-referral to a gastroenterologist for evaluation. But any time you have black tarry stool or bright red blood, it needs to be evaluated. That's not something that should be overlooked.
Moving along the male not the gastrointestinal tract, but the urological tract, what is the prostate and where is it located, and how is it important to men's health?
It's almost more of a pain in the neck than anything else. It's basically the gland in between the bladder and the penis, the urethra, the urine tube, runs right through the middle of it, and it produces semen, or the white fluid that we have when we ejaculate. It doesn't hold on to the semen. There are little kind of bags underneath called seminal vesicles that hold on to it that we actually squeeze and emit semen when we ejaculate. But the prostate's responsible for making the semen. What does it do for us? Early in life, it's important because it's hard to have kids without semen. Later in life, it almost does nothing but act as a reservoir for prostate infections and cancer. It keeps me in business. So it's it's present and it's accountable for many men. It can relate to urinary tract obstruction as it grows. It grows out, which really doesn't matter. So large size is not as important as the fact that it grows inward and closes off that urinary tract or that urethra. That's when men can develop nighttime issues with having to wake up to go to the bathroom, slow urinary stream, dribble, a slow stream where you can barely get beyond your tips of your shoes to pee, things like that. So
the condition of benign prostate hyperplasia, is that what you're speaking of in terms of the normal growth of the prostate? So I'm thinking that the prostate normally grows throughout lifetime.
It does. That's correct.
And so symptoms, as you mentioned, would be symptoms of benign prostate hyperplasia.
Yes.
What would be a symptom that a man should look for if he's concerned about prostate cancer?
You know, prostate cancer really doesn't have symptoms. When prostate cancer, men with prostate cancer rather present with symptoms, it's basically already spread and there's not a lot we can do for it. We can manage the disease to some extent, but we can't cure it at that point. So symptomatic prostate cancer is a real problem. In general, when we talk about prostate cancer, we talk about screening. And screening requires two things, a PSA test, which is a simple blood test, and a rectal exam, which is a very simple, painless exam. I had a guy complain about it once, and I said, listen, you poop bigger than my finger. And he said, yeah, but there's no bone in my poop. So, it's... it's an uncomfortable exam, probably more emotionally than physically, but part of what we need to do is help men understand that. And there was actually a really neat campaign probably about 20 years ago where George Foreman did a poster for the American Cancer Society with, gloved and said, basically, real men get it checked.
We're going to get back to the prostate here in just a second. Our number here is 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our guest tonight, Dr. Lauren Smith, urology at Pyrmont in Shreveport, Terry Eberhardt, Eberhardt Physical Therapy, and Dr. Mark Vegan, clinical psychologist in Shreveport. So the PSA test, you mentioned this as a screening test for prostate cancer. What does the PSA stand for, and how is it a screening test for prostate cancer?
PSA is prostate-specific antigen, and it's a substance that's basically made only in the prostate. As men age, we do expect that it will rise. The values in terms of what's normal, there are different theories on what constitutes normal. There's good data to show that basically a cutoff of 4, meaning anything below 4 is a normal value, anything above 4 is abnormal. There's also good data showing that the risk of finding prostate cancer in any man with a PSA above 2.5 is about equal to the risk of finding prostate cancer in any man with a value above 4. So it's a moving target. I tend to believe in what's called age-adjusted PSA, meaning younger men should have lower PSAs than older men. So men in their 40s, I believe, should be below 2.5. Men in their 50s, below 3.5. Everyone else, I use 4 as a cutoff. Part of the debate right now, however, is who should we be screening for prostate cancer and at what age? We know that it's a hereditary disease, meaning men with a primary family history, fathers, brothers, etc., are at higher risk for prostate cancer. They probably deserve earlier screening. The AUA used to recommend very early screening for men starting around age 40, 45. About a year and a half or 2 years ago, Preventive Medicine Task Force came up with a D rating for PSA screening, which basically states that screening for prostate cancer actually causes more problems than it solves. That's a big debate right now. I think that there are good arguments on both sides of that debate. I think it's very important for patients, for men, to have that discussion with their doctor. And I'm starting to see fewer and fewer primary care physicians have that discussion with patients and simply refer them to me to have that discussion, which is fine.
So the PSA level is important, and discuss that with your primary care physician and perhaps see a urologist if you're not sure exactly what to do with that value.
Absolutely.
We have another call from the internet. And for erectile dysfunction, for those who cannot take Viagra and the other erectile dysfunction drugs, should they try testosterone or even human growth hormone?
No.
Simple answer.
Yes. again, like I said earlier in the program, the idea that low testosterone is the cause of erectile dysfunction is very low probability. So if oral medicines don't work and men have a normal libido or desire for intercourse, I really think that then it's time to start talking about injectable therapies or vacuum erection devices or inflatable penile prostheses or something else other than just testosterone.
And as a urologist, how do you make the decision with the patient in terms of which of the other alternative erectile dysfunction therapies to use, injection, vacuum, or implant?
That's a good question. I kind of have an algorithm. I like to get men on oral medicines if possible. Some of them can tolerate them and get good results. Some can't. The cost can be an issue, to be honest. You know, these pills can be anywhere from $10 to $25 per pill per dose, so that can really add up. One of the nice things about Cialis is that there is a daily dosing, so you can reduce the cost to patients who are having intercourse more than two times a week. But if the oral medicines don't work, I like to move them toward injection therapy because there are a wide range of compounded medicines that we can use that are effective. And when I say a wide range, basically a wide range of doses that we can provide for patients. And usually we can get a good result with the injectable therapies. It's not very painful. It's easy to administer. A little more difficult in obese patients, but if they've got a partner that's interested, the partner can certainly help out. Vacuum erection devices, I think, are great. They're a little bit cumbersome, but when they work, they can provide a very satisfactory erection. Patients and their partners can be very happy. And then, of course, prostheses are there, but that's a surgical procedure that can be very expensive at times, may or may not be well covered by insurance policies, etc. But a lot of it depends on the patient goal. You know, patients kind of have a thought in mind about what they're willing to try versus what they're not willing to try. And sometimes it's a matter of bringing them in three or four times, trying different, less invasive approaches, getting them used to the idea that they either do want or don't want an erection, and then they can make decisions from there. It's very individual.
Let's go back to the issue of prostate cancer a little bit more. How do you stage prostate cancer, and how does that guide treatment once it's detected? Let's say we have an elevated PSA level. You do further evaluations. What's that evaluation going to look like for the patient?
Sure.
And depending on the stage of the cancer, assuming that it's contained within the prostate and it's not widely metastatic, what's that process going to look like for the patient?
Sure, that's a great question. Essentially, the first thing we do is we have to biopsy in order to find the cancer. And so the trigger for a biopsy is going to be either an abnormal or an elevated PSA or an abnormal rectal exam. If either one of those is not within what we consider normal limits, then we recommend a biopsy. The biopsy comes back positive. Then what we do is we look at the PSA level prior to the biopsy to help determine whether we need to proceed with staging evaluation or not. In general, a PSA that's below, say, 15 or 20 probably does not need, in fact, really does not need staging at that point. We used to traditionally order a CAT scan and a bone scan on all patients with prostate cancer, but what we found is that you really don't have a positive study that would change your management in patients that have relatively low PSAs. And when I say relatively low, again, I'm talking about a PSA below 20. So the way I describe it to patients is we can't see individual cells that have spread and that have left the prostate. We just can't see them. We don't have the technology for that. So if you look at a tree from a distance, you can see the green leaves, plural. You can see the number of leaves that are there, but you can't pick out an individual leaf. Our technology allows us to see those leaves, but not the individual leaf. So in order for a test to be positive, you'd have to have a very high PSA level. So in general, if the PSA levels are relatively low and the man has prostate cancer, we assume that it's locally confined. And then we look at his well-being as an individual. We look at all of his other medical problems, his social concerns in terms of does he have erections, does he not have erections, what is his family life like, how involved is his family in what's going on. And then we come to realization or come to discussion and conclusions about what treatment to offer.
Okay, we're getting bounced back to ED again, so let's address this question. If cost is an issue, are generic ED drugs or those from other countries as effective as the branded drugs here in the United States?
I have no idea. I have a number of patients who will come in saying that they get their Viagra from Canada or from Mexico or overseas elsewhere. They say that they work. I never prescribe them that way. I really can't comment on safety. I mean, I assume that they're safe, but that's an assumption, and that can get patients in trouble. So I think that you're safest getting your medicines inside the United States. If cost is an issue and oral medicines are too expensive, again, what I try and do is transition patients into compounded injectables. Brand name injectables are ridiculously expensive, $40 or $50 per dose. So, you go the wrong way if you get brand name medications there. But the compounded medicines can be very, very reasonably priced.
Speaking in terms of cost, do you know if the pharmaceutical companies have patient assistance programs for these drugs?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that they have them for other medications, but for ED drugs, I'm not sure.
And are they covered by insurance plans?
Most do not cover them. That's been my experience. Even with Cialis now having an indication for BPH treatment, we've had difficulty getting it covered.
We have a caller from Shreveport. Sandy is on the line. Sandy, what's your question?
Yes, hi. What is a midlife crisis?
Dr. Vegan, what is a midlife crisis as it pertains to men's health?
Well, I would say that a midlife crisis, from a traditional psychological point of view, is that is explained by Jung and Freud and those original theorists. Most of us are born either introverted and extroverted. Extroverts, usually are people that want to spend a lot of their energy on the outside world interacting with other people. Introverts sort of keep it to themselves. And we're sort of born with this introverted, extroverted style. And in the midlife, as midlife kind of approaches, people sort of begin to develop the other side of their personalities. So somebody who is formerly a strong introvert may become more extroverted, may become more outgoing, and may develop other skills and problem-solving styles, etc., that he formerly was not using, whereas extroverts may become less extroverted, more introverted, and so on. So I think a midlife crisis in general has to do with a person's personality changing. And it may be changing in a way where some strengths and so on that have been used and relied upon for many years are sort of set into second place, and where new abilities and new strengths, new ways of approaching life are embraced. And so people have that can be kind of shocking, I guess, for individuals. And of course, most people. Secondly, I guess when a lot of people want to change their circumstances rather than really changing themselves when they arrive at a particular problem. And so a lot of people, when they're when they feel uncertain or confused in midlife, often look to circumstantial changes rather than internal changes and so on. And so midlife changes can often come with crises I think it's a matter of changing personality styles.
Sandy, thank you for your call. Again, our number here is 1-800-552-8502. We're listening to Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our guests tonight include Dr. Lauren Smith, urology at Piermont in Shreveport, part of the Willis-Knighton healthcare system, Terry Eberhardt, Eberhardt Physical Therapy, and Dr. Mark Vegan, clinical psychologist in Shreveport. Dr. Vegan, the National Institute of Mental Health has put forward some facts pertaining to suicide that I was reading recently, and this has particular importance to men's health. In 2006, 33,000 suicides occurred. That's 11 per 100,000. More than 90% of people who kill themselves have a diagnosable mental disorder, most commonly a depressive disorder or substance abuse disorder. The highest suicide rates in the United States are found in white men over the age of 85. That's a staggering statistic. Four times as many men as women die as a result of suicide.
Yes.
However, women attempt suicide 2 to 3 times more often than men. And men are much more likely to be successful, is what we've always been taught. Men are more successful at suicide. They don't attempt it as often.
They use more lethal means to achieve it.
So what do you make of these statistics in terms of men, perhaps a midlife crisis or aging, and how it affects mental health in men?
Well, of course, we know that suicide is associated with these other comorbid issues, depression, anxiety, certainly important with regard to chronic illness. And older men who have a chronic illness are going to be at an increased risk, of course. I guess if you look at the prevalence, too, also there's a suicide peak. It's kind of a bimodal distribution. Older folks as well as new peak in younger people. Increased risk with suicide for adolescents and so on. There's a number of reasons for that, as well as older people with chronic illnesses, younger people with high expectations that they're not meeting with parents, breakup of relationships, and so on. So it's you sort of have a peak at the younger age, which is growing, and also at the older age. So suicide, and of course associated with affective disorders, and I guess the prevalence of depressive disorders, or the chance that a person's going to have a depressive disorder is about 15% across the United States, for a severe anxiety disorder about 19%. And men experience those disorders usually with denial. They don't want to recognize those disorders. They don't want to ask for help. Women will more often than not ask for help. Men will not ask for help. And there's sort of a conspiracy of silence around depression. For example, if we know somebody's depressed, we sort of leave them alone. And that's the opposite of what we need to do. Anxious people go out and bother people. Depressed people kind of want to fade back into the woodwork, and we sort of co-conspire with them and let them do that.
Yeah, let's come back to that in a moment. We have a caller from Shreveport. Terry, what's your question?
Yes, the breast cancer examination is so prevalent on television that even I know how to do it, but I've never heard anyone address the issue of testicular cancer and if there is, in fact, a self-examination that a man can do so that he would know whether he needs to see a urologist or address it with his GP.
That's a great question, Terry. Thank you for asking that question. Dr. Smith, testicular examinations, in particular self-examination.
Yeah, I want to thank Terry for asking that question. I've got it on my list, and I'm glad we're able to get to it. Essentially, what we recommend is that men probably in their late teens, early 20s, do a self-exam probably once a month. I think more often than that is not going to be helpful. Essentially, what men are looking for is anything that doesn't feel normal. So you've got two testicles. Most men have two testicles. The part that's large, that feels like an egg, should be very round, should not have any lumps or bumps. It should be smooth, and they should be fairly equal in size. If it is hard, if you feel a nodule, if you feel a bump that shouldn't be there, or something new, then you need to get it checked out. The simple way that I explain to patients whether it's an abnormality or not is I tell patients to make a fist. And if you run your finger over your knuckle, that's a mass on the inside that's protruding out. That's what a mass would feel like in the testicle. Now, keep in mind that on top of the testicle, there's a part of the tract, if you will, called the epididymis. And I describe it like a hat or a wig that's on top of the testicle. So you'll feel that when you do an exam. That's normal. It's supposed to be there. Bumps in the epididymis tend to be benign. But unless you really know what you're doing and have experience, or someone, a physician has explained it to you, if you feel something abnormal in either spot, you really ought to get it checked out. There can be a thing called a plaque that's on the outside of the testicle itself, or it's in the side of the scrotum, but it's on the testicle covering. it feels kind of like a wedding band, meaning if you take your finger and run it across your wedding band, you feel a step off. You feel that bump or where your fingernail wants to stop. Those tend to be benign, but again, if it's an abnormality, it's something that you need to get checked out.
So any abnormality, get it checked out.
Absolutely.
And don't wait. And what would that evaluation look like in terms of after the visit to the urologist? What would the patient expect at that point?
Probably the most important thing is the fact that he's going to get a good, competent exam by trained hands. And that's really the important thing.
And how prevalent is testicular cancer? What's the normal stage at diagnosis, and what's the prognosis? It's normally spoken to be quite favorable in most cases. So can we speak a little bit about that?
Sure. Often we do find it at low stage. Testis cancer does have a tendency to spread. It's a very rapidly growing cancer. So men that have a mass really do need to get in and get it checked right away. I see a number of men with testis cancer who kind of disregarded their mass and allowed it to grow for weeks or even months. And that's just, you should not do that, because it will double in size anywhere from 30 to 40 days, which means it's a very rapidly expanding tumor. Many times we find that the CAT scan that we order at the time of testis cancer diagnosis does not show disease in the back of the abdomen, but that's where it likes to spread. Part of the problem, though, is that depending upon the cell type, and there are a number of different cell types out there, they're all kind of testis cancer, but there are different types of testis cancer. They have different degrees to which they will spread, even when you don't see it on a CAT scan. So once we treat the initial testis cancer, we almost always treat the retroperitoneum or the back of the abdomen.
And how would that be treated?
Depends on the type of cancer. We really separate it into seminoma or non-seminoma. Seminoma will benefit from radiation therapy, very high success rates in keeping the cancer from recurring in that area. Non-seminoma can be a pure non-seminoma, or it can be a mixed tumor, meaning different cell types. And in general, we can observe patients, meaning get serial CAT scans every couple months to look and see if the nodal disease pops up. We can treat with a couple cycles of chemotherapy, or we can treat with an extensive surgery called retroperitoneal lymph node dissection. The latter two are really curative, or can be curative. The former really is not.
How often does orchiectomy, or removal of the testicles, occur?
How often?
How often is that required in the treatment of testicular cancer?
Oh, in the treatment of cancer?
Is that routine?
Oh, absolutely,
that has to
be done.
And it's done bilaterally at that point?
No. What happens is a man presents with a mass, and we do an examination, and we find a nodule. Send him for an ultrasound to confirm that it's an intratesticular solid mass. At that point, we'll get him in the operating room and perform his orchiectomy, usually within a couple of days. We really don't wait around a long time, again, because it's a very fast-growing tumor. We do get some blood work ahead of time. There's some tumor markers that we will order and try and get those lab values ahead of time. And at some point, either before or after the orchiectomy or removal of the testicle, we'll order the CAT scan. But it's a bilateral disease in about 2% of patients.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. I want to thank our panelists, Dr. Lauren Smith, urology at Piermont, Terry Eberhardt, Eberhardt Physical Therapy in Shreveport, Dr. Mark Vegan, clinical psychologist here in Shreveport. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. The show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance was provided by Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Jeff Bryant. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening.